travelers. Today's special guest is Miles Anderson. You know him as Lennox in The Tragedy of Macbeth, starring Denzel Washington, now on Apple Plus. Come join me as we go traversing the stars. Hello, Mr. Anderson. Thank you so much for coming to the Traversing the Stars podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's totally my pleasure, sir. You are awesome. I got to watch you in The Tragedy of Macbeth, and you are fantastic.
Bless you. Thank you very much.
100% my pleasure. I always like to start off asking this question to my guests, especially the ones who are actors. I ask, what inspired you to become an actor, and who were your earliest influences?
It's a long story.
Go right ahead.
So I was brought up in what was then Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe. I was born there. My mother was born there. My father was born in South Africa. And becoming an actor really wasn't a choice. I had always had a penchant for the country, for the bush. I'd been on an expedition in the eastern highlands of Zimbabwe, where I'd found a plant which was later ended up in Kew Gardens, the first of its kind.
Oh, wow.
It's called Podocarpus melangiensis chironii.
Holy crap.
And that was the name of the expedition. So I was into botany and plants and trees. They're still my first love. I adore trees. I think I can probably name every single tree in California, certainly in my area anyway. Most of them are from Australia. But so I was born and I was brought up in this very a wonderful childhood. We used to go hunting. We used to go to far flung corners of the countryside. And Rhodesia was becoming gradually more and more right wing. My father was in command of the whole of the army of Rhodesia, what is now Malawi, Zambia, Malawi and Zambia and Rhodesia. Now, they're all separate countries now, but they were in a federation. And my father had been in command of all the armies, and he was asked to stay on and take command of the Rhodesian army under a new prime minister who was very right-wing. My father had always been... had hoped for a multiracial country, a truly multiracial country, and a country where people got on and people respected each other, despite being of different races. And the country was becoming gradually, as I say, more and more right-wing, and my father was trying everything he could to stop it. And in the end, he wanted to stage a coup d'etat, but unfortunately he didn't have a lot of support from the rest of the army. So it failed, and the prime minister had got to hear about it and booted him out of the army unceremoniously under a terrible clause, which was basically to do with if the commander of the army was a drunk or a drug addict or whatever, he could be dismissed. My father was terribly ashamed of what had happened. They also removed our house from us, took his cars away, froze our bank balance. My father couldn't get a job anyway. So I'm in this situation, also desperately trying to pass an exam which would get me an entrance to a South African university. I had in my childhood numerous bangs on my head. I think I suffered 7 complete knockouts before I was 16. My very first one was being dropped into a swimming pool. I told you this is going to be a long story.
No, go for it.
I was dropped on my head into an empty swimming pool when I was 9 months old. I went into convulsions. I said to my mother, "What did you do?" She said, "Well, we put you on the kitchen table and we just waited till you came around." I said, "Well, how about calling 999? She said, "Don't be stupid. This is Rhodesian." She said, "There was no such thing." So this is a terrible plug. I wrote a book in COVID, in fact, last year, and I had it published. And it's just won an honorable mention in the Californian Book Fair. And in it, it has a chapter completely devoted to being knocked out. And this is the book. It's called Colonels, Cads, and Charmers. And it basically deals with being a colonial kid who then ends up going to England to become an actor. So what happened was, because of the situation with my father, he then had to leave the country, and he went to Zambia. And my mother called me into the room and said, "What are you going to do with your life?" I was desperately trying to pass exams, but I kept failing them. And I said, I don't know. I want to be a game ranger. And she said, "A game ranger? What on earth makes you think that a game you're going to survive as a game ranger? You'll get shot, and it'll be a white man that shoots you." So she dissuaded me from this idea of becoming a game ranger, which was really what I wanted to do. I was desperate to live a very simple life in the bush. And she said, "Why don't you become a hotelier? And you can get a scholarship to go to Lausanne in Switzerland and become a hotelier. And because I like cooking." You know, that was the other thing I liked. So I thought about that for a while, and it still didn't ring any bells in my head. And then she said to me one day, "You know, you always show off. You're always showing off or playing the fool. Why don't you become an actor?" And I said, "Oh, I don't think you can become an actor. I think you have to be the son of an actor, don't you?" And she said, "No, there are things called drama schools, and you can go there." And she said, I said, "Well, maybe I could go to America." My big hero at that time was, there were two of them, James Dean and Marlon Brando. I just thought with the bee's knees, you know, like they were the most, as far as I was concerned, East of Eden was my favorite number one film. This film, the scene that he has with his father in it when he talks about trying to grow whatever he was trying to grow, and he bursts into tears. And it's still a brilliant scene. And he was a brilliant actor. So I thought, well, maybe that's what I want to become, a film star. And maybe I could make a movie with Steve McQueen and people like that. So I said to my father, "Where should I go to become an actor? Where should I go and train? Should I go to America or England?" Now, why I was asking a general of an army which drama school I should go to, I have no idea. But in those days, you asked your father told you what to do, and that's what you did. And he said, "No, I think if you want to become a proper actor, you go to England." And I said, "Well, I'm not sure I want to become what do you mean a proper actor?" He said, "If you want to become a classical actor." I said, "Oh my God, I don't want to become a classic. I hated classical music. Now I was going to become a classical actor." Anyway, he persuaded me that was a good idea. And if I got into the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, he would pay my tuition. So that's what I did. I got on a plane, flew to England, and which was like going to Mars, really. I mean, the only thing that we had in common was that we both spoke the same language, the English and myself. So I could understand what they were talking about, but I found them very strange. I thought that they smelt bad. I thought that the whole place was very damp. And I couldn't believe that people lived so close to each other. And I spent a miserable year auditioning I auditioned for RADA and failed completely. They said at the time, because I learned afterwards, that they couldn't understand a word I was saying. I decided that I would do Hotspur's speech from Henry IV, part one. And I thought I would assume a Northumbrian accent, which I assumed to be somewhere up the north of England, where the vowels were rather flat. I was also told that Hotspur had a speech impediment. So I thought a stutter would be very good as well. So it'd be good to stutter on the word pee. But then I thought maybe pee and something else as well. So with this awful accent imposed on what was a very, very strong Rhodesian accent, a bit like a South African accent, plus a stutter, nobody understood a word of what I was saying. Not so I sort of fell into the doldrums. I sent my mother a telegram. In those days, it was a telegram to say, "Failed, Miles." And she had pictures of me throwing myself over the Tower Bridge or somewhere to end my days. But I then auditioned again. I phoned them up and I said, "I would love to audition for you again." And by this time, I was working in stores selling underwear to majors and colonels at a place called the Army and Navy Stores. You'd be surprised what sort of strange underwear generals, colonels, and majors wear, I can tell you. And so I was doing this job and working as a petrol pump attendant. In those days, people didn't fill their own cars. You filled it for them and you got good, great tips. So doing all sorts of other jobs to keep myself afloat. And I auditioned again for RADA, but this time I'd learned to get rid of most of my accent. And I auditioned and I got into RADA. So now I'm at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art. I'm just like an empty book, an empty vessel. I just absorbed everything that I was told. This is what you do. And I called everybody sir. Sir or madam, I used to call them.
Yeah.
And until they persuaded me that that wasn't done, really. And then one, I left RADA with, I in fact got the Ronson Award, which was an award for the most outstanding actor of the year in a performance. And plus a number of other awards, I was able to pay my last year's tuition. So my dad didn't have to face that. And then I thought, well, I don't know what to do, but maybe the Royal Academy. So maybe I should go to the Royal Shakespeare Company. I thought that sounded pretty good. In those days, you couldn't just walk into television or film. You had to have 40 weeks experience on your equity ticket before you could go before you could do television. So consequently, all the actors British actors, English actors, who were doing television serials or doing films, had 40 weeks experience in what was called repertory theater, in the theater. And that's what I did. I joined the Royal Shakespeare Company. I played walk-ons, and but I acted with some great people. I mean, I was on the stage with Dame Peggy Ashcroft, Judi Dench. I've done masses and masses of plays with her. It's wonderful actors who you learn a tremendous amount from. And I suppose that was really my real learning experience. I'd also spent some time at the Bristol Old Vic after the Royal Shakespeare Company, where I was taught by a wonderful director called Richard Cottrell. And then I went back and forth to the Royal Shakespeare Company. I spent 10 years there altogether in a number of different, at different stages. I worked a lot with a director called Adrian Noble, and John Barton, of course, was the world's, probably still is, the world's greatest exponent on Shakespeare. So I was with John Barton for 10 whole years, Adrian Noble for 4 or 5. And that's what I did. I worked in the theater. I got married and had started a family, and the theater wasn't enough to bring in enough for what we needed to pay our mortgage and keep afloat. So I started doing television, and that was kind of my existence for the next 30 years. I'm trying to think, 30, 40 years, probably, no, 30 years. I ended up doing series after series after series, and I began to establish myself in England as an actor. I don't think I ever auditioned in the last 10 years before I came to America. I had never auditioned. And then in 2008, I decided I really have to go to America, because that's where I'd wanted to go in the beginning. And people were saying to me, "You're crazy, man. You what are you doing? You've got a brilliant career here." And I said, "Yeah, but I want to go to America. I just want to go to America." And I'd been to teach. I taught acting at a place called James Madison University in Harrisonburg, Virginia, at the bequest of a wonderful, wonderful man called Tom Arthur, and I directed a play there, and I liked direct. I thought, oh, this is fun, directing as well. But I loved America. I just loved the fact that, you know, the food was different, but it was, and this was Virginia, for God's sake. You know, I didn't know about Donald Trump and his supporters. but I thought California was great. And I've always suffered from asthma. So coming to America was brilliant for me, at my health anyway. And that's what I did. I flew over in October, November. We both came over, my wife and I, just at the time of the writer's strike, which didn't do us any good at all. My wife is a PhD and also an author of many, many, many books mostly on Stanislavski and the method system. And so she got a job at the UC system. She's an actress as well, but she was able to keep us afloat, certainly while I started trying to hunt for work. And of course, it was extremely difficult because nobody knew who the hell I was. You know, I may have had a career in England, but nobody knew about that. And, so I think that's basically it, really. And now I'm here, and I love America. I'm not so sure about the politics. Some of it reminds me so much of living in Rhodesia. There's an awful racial discrimination that goes on in this country, which really upsets me. I can't believe that human beings behave towards other human beings in that way. And it's 2022. I just think it's crazy, completely yes. crazy why there's so much hate in this world, certainly in America. So as to how much longer I will stay here, I am an American citizen. I took it out. Thank God I had Barack Obama sign my papers because my wife had Donald Trump sign.
Oh, no.
Yes. They'll probably be able to sell it for a load of money. So, you know, I'm here for the conceivable future. Like any actor, it's probably itinerantly. I still audition for every single role that I get. But I think that's very good because it removes your ego. And as I always say to students, if I go and teach a class at UC or something, I always say to students, you've got to get rid of your egos, because you'll never be able to sublimate your ego for someone else, for the characters. And if your ego is so strong, your character's ego will never be able to impinge on that. And they always sort of look at me very oddly and say, shouldn't we have egos? Isn't that what it's all about? It's being confident. I said, no, confidence is something else. Confidence just comes from being reasonable, really, being good, people accepting you. You know, it comes from, there's a wonderful book that Eric Byrne wrote called Games People Play. And he says in it that, you know, if you get a certain amount of good strokes per day, you feel great. People say to you, hi, Jeff, and you say, hi, Jeff, how are you? Great. Hey, Jeff, lovely to see you. At the end of the day, Jeff, you're feeling fantastic. But if you say to walk into a somewhere and go, hi, everybody, and they go, asshole, why are we doing it? At the end of the day, you will feel terrible. And I think so much of acting is to do with confidence. How confident are you to be able to do something? I still suffer terrible nerves from acting. I did something recently with Al Pacino, and it was like working with God. I was working, you know, I made a terrible, terrible blunders during my whatever I had to say. I completely froze up. And he said to me, are you okay? And I said, yes, but you can't believe what I'm going through. I'm going through this terrible thing of going, oh my God, I'm working with Al Pacino. For God's sake, you know, this is Al Pacino. Same thing happens with Denzel Washington, who I've worked with twice. I'm overawed sometimes by my fellow actors, especially if they're very, very good actors.
Well, you know, so many things that you covered, which I just find fascinating. The first thing is, I did not know about the book, and I wish I had known so I could have read it before the interview, because it sounds like a fantastic book.
A lot of people tell me it's very, very funny. It makes people laugh a lot, and it makes people cry a lot. Mm-hmm. And I always think if you can laugh and you can cry reading a book, it's a good read. I hate to sort of to blow my own trumpet. As my father would always say, why do you blow your own trumpet? Let other people blow it for you. And I'd say, but they might never blow my trumpet, Dad. Sorry.
I'm going to say the story about your father too sounds like it's movie worthy. Have you considered doing that as a movie?
Well, you know, my mother wrote a brilliant book called The Toe Rags. Her name is Daphne Anderson, and it became a seminal book in Rhodesia and certainly in Southern Africa. The famous Robert Mugabe, the dictator, wrote her a wonderful letter which said that he couldn't believe that Europeans lived that sort of life in Africa. And he had recommended this book to every single school child in Zimbabwe to realize that there was another side to being a colonial. My mother was brought up in dirt poor circumstances. I mean, really dirt poor. By the time she was 18, she had to have every single one of her teeth removed. I mean, and that's, you know, because of the bad diet that she had suffered. And she wrote this wonderful book. And so she's passed the baton on to me. She resides up in heaven at the moment, but she's not going anywhere.
Hopefully not. I like to think that she didn't do anything to piss off Evan.
I don't think so.
we can't have this person here any longer. See ya. But like I said, your story is just so incredible. And having been in Zimbabwe, having been in England, having come to America, having those three experiences, how has that, you think, affected you as an actor?
I think all, you know, living informs on who you are and what you are. And I think you bring that anyway into your acting. I'm trying to think how it's going to sound terrible because it's in a way boastful, but I'm not boastful. I don't. I think all my work, when I look at my work and I go, yeah, it's okay. I think every job that I do, I could have done that a little bit better than that. And that's not something that goes down well in America. In America, you have to say everything's fantastic. How are you? I'm awesome. How was the performance? It was awesome. Everything is awesome and fantastic. And you asked me a question. Most people say, oh, that's a really good question, Jeff. And they're saying that's a really good question because someone's taught them to say that because it gives them time to think about what they're going to say. So I'm purposely not doing that. Probably while I'll put my foot in it at any given moment. I'm trying to think of the question. I think it's probably given me a certain humility. I'm not sure if that's good or bad for an actor. But I think that's the sort of life I've led. I have led a wonderful, wonderful life. I have very, very few regrets. I've made terrible mistakes in my life, which I've done, but I don't regret them one minute. I think they've all added to the richness of my work. And I hope that's what I bring to the screen or to the stage. I still work in the theater. I spent 4 years when I first came here at the San Diego at the Old Globe, and I had a wonderful time. I played Prospero ended up playing Shylock, which is a role I'd always wanted to play. So I have very few ambitions left. I just want to keep acting. There are a couple of plays I would really like to do. One is King Lear. And the other one is a play by a French writer called André Aubé, and it's called Noah, and it's about Noah. And it's very, very funny. It's about Noah's conversations with God. I highly recommend it. His conversations with God are so funny. So those are the two parts I want to do. And I just want to stay alive. I'm a bit of a political activist. I have been probably since 1995. Yeah, I just want to continue. Life is good. You know, I'm not in Ukraine. Whenever I think how awful life can be, oh my God, how desperate, oh my God, I failed the audition. Oh God, bang my head against the wall. Jeepers. All I have to think of is being a woman who's giving birth in a public car park in Kiev. And it's 3 o'clock in the morning and the place is full of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of damaged people. That brings me up with a jolt. That's important. That's suffering. Whether I got the audition or not, that's really, really, you know, neither here nor there. What are we worried about?
You know, I'll say the war going on right now between Russia and Ukraine definitely allows things to be put in perspective. I mean, as a high school teacher currently, I do think within the last 48 hours, kid complained about some bullshit. And I was just like, yeah, you know, I was like, first world problem, you know, try to live in what's going on, you know, in, you know, Ukraine or something like that, and see if, which is first world, obviously, at the moment too. And, you know, see what real problems look like. You know, that is a problem. What you're doing is a complaint. There's two different, yeah. There's two, yeah, separate things, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and having, once again, being able to look at this country from an outsider's perspective, because once again, you didn't grow up in the States. What do you see in our politics that you did not see in either England or Zimbabwe? That is definitely problematic of what's going on right now.
I hope we don't. What are your what do you think about what will happen in Ukraine?
Unfortunately, as people have told me, I'm a cynic and a pessimist. Unfortunately, my guess, if I were to make a guess, would be eventually the Ukraine falls to Russia. My guess is within a few weeks. The sanctions that are held against Putin were already expected probably by Putin. I think he knew what was going to happen before he started. He knew the sanctions were going to happen. He knew most of this was going to happen. It's been pre-planned, which is why apparently has a nest egg he's been sitting on for quite some time, as does his friends, I'm sure. And I think after he realizes the West is not going to get involved, he'll move on to the next former Soviet satellite country and invade that one as well. And he will reform Russia the way he remembered it being when he was in KGB. And I think that's where we're headed.
Wow.
Yeah,
I'll try and be the optimist.
Yeah, unfortunately, I'll be the optimist. People tells me.
No. I think that's perfectly valid. I mean, I'm an optimist, and my projection would be, well, he couldn't beat the Chechens, and he couldn't beat the Taliban. So, what happens when this war of his becomes a terrorist warfare? What happens when he tries to occupy? It's a huge country to occupy. What's he going to do? He's going to put troops in every single town, huge numbers of troops in every single town. How do you stop a population who's all armed now? You know, they were armed years ago. Mm. They've been fighting a war for what, seven years now? Mm. So they're battle hardened. They know what to do. They've managed to hold the Russian advance. And I think it might be a war of attrition. And if it is a war of attrition, the longer the Russians are, it takes for the Russians to completely subdue the Ukraine, the more it will be in Ukraine's favor. So I'm a little divided.
I mean,
I'm the optimist. I think,
yeah, well, sir, you're certainly the optimist. Like I said, I think this, if that goes that way and it's a war of attrition, I think Russia's side will get nastier and nastier.
Yeah.
Dirtier and dirtier. The question will be, what is the will of the Ukrainian people? How strongly, I mean, having that in the older population, they had previously been part of Russia, how easy will they finally relent and be, I guess, I don't want to say not satisfied, that's not the right word, but decide that it's just not worth the death toll that's going to happen to keep fighting this.
Can't go back. He can't go back defeated. He that would be the end of him.
Right. So that's also a major problem. It's interesting. The timing of the war, unfortunately, was interesting. With I'm a high school teacher. During the day, I teach English, often Shakespeare. But I teach English, and we were one of the assignments that I had planned to teach. Goes over with Benjamin Franklin, the idea of, more or less, paraphrase, the importance of safety versus freedom. And I think that's the argument Ukrainians have to deal with themselves right now. Is freedom more important or safety? And I think we're going to find out what that answer is within the next few weeks.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely, absolutely, utterly right. How do your students take to Shakespeare?
Not well. I will say that I teach at a therapeutic high school.
Yeah.
So most of our students, thank you. Most of our students do have not only emotional issues, but because of their emotional issues, and a lot of them have not had consistent schooling for many years. So I would say they're academically flabby in that sense. So something like Shakespeare is definitely difficult because they have difficulties with more standard modern books, so Shakespeare adds a little more complexity to it. I will toot my horn and say I'm very good at teaching it, so they do understand it usually. Though I did have one student that I think it was last year that freaked me out after we were reading Macbeth, and we got to Act Three, and I asked her a question about Macbeth. I was like, you know, I can't remember what the question was, but I asked the question. She looked at me in dead honesty, and she said, "Who is Macbeth?" And I was like, "We've been reading the book for 3 acts. You voiced and read Macbeth multiple times." And she said, "Yeah. Who is he?" And I said, "Okay, let's start back from stage one." And
no, I understand, though. I would have said, well, she's may have been asking the question, who is he in terms of what is his character? Who is he? Well, he's a thane. He's a sir. He's a knight. You know, I always say to students who don't like Shakespeare, I say, the problem is you mustn't just read it. You must speak it aloud, because only by speaking it aloud will you ever really begin to understand it. And the thing about Shakespeare, certainly Macbeth, I played the role at Stratford-on-Avon and back then in London in 1989. Mm. And Macbeth is a very, it's kind of easy because it's a pretty simple plot. They're not 16 other things going on at the same time. Mm. And it's, you know, relatively small cast.
Yeah, I found the same thing. It was in my school or my curriculum. Julius Caesar is taught to sophomores and Macbeth is taught to juniors. I flipped it because I felt the complexities of Macbeth. I mean, it's a fairly direct story. As long as you know Macbeth and Lady Macbeth, the story is pretty straightforward. Well, Caesar is way, way more convoluted with a whole lot of other people.
My God, you know, yes. Yeah, I mean, you're talking politics, really, when you do Caesar, don't you?
Yeah, and I will say one issue, because like I said, therapeutic high school, a lot of my students deal with autism. So the issue that they have is they don't understand subtext. It's just because, you know, their brains aren't designed to understand it. So Shakespeare can be complicated, especially Julius Caesar, which is loaded with, you know, subtext and assembling and everything else. Macbeth, again, is still way more straightforward. So if you understand, can't, you know, between the lines, you can still get the plot, which is one. It's actually one of my favorite plays. And I'm actually going to be teaching Macbeth, God, in maybe 3 weeks to my sophomores. And, you know, it's fantastic. And I will say, we read it out loud. And I will act out the scenes during the class.
Oh, brilliant. No, that's brilliant. And get them to listen to their hearts. Their hearts go ba-boom, 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 ba-boom. So they actually, Shakespeare is really kind of clever. I mean, it's a iambic beat, isn't it? It goes da-dum, 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 da-dum. And if you, I would say the little rules about Shakespeare, you must have an upward inflection at the end of the line. If you have an upward inflection at the end of the line, it actually will drive you into the next line. Drive you into the next line, and you'll get an energy behind what you're saying. And yeah, encourage those autistic people and those people that have problems to be declamatory about it, rather than to do film acting, you know. Shakespeare didn't have films. He didn't have a television camera at the time.
Well, I may have to put you on the spot. Just to let you know, I do guest speakers with my students on Zoom once a month. We've had the writer from Mississippi Burning, screenwriter.
Yeah, it would be my absolute pleasure.
I will hold you to that when this is over, and I will contact you about it. Because like I said, we do it. We have, usually it's Q&A, three questions. Each student writes 3 questions. And it's usually about 20 minutes long, 30 minutes long. And they usually really are fascinated by it. And that would be fantastic.
That would be so much fun. You do a great job. I have great respect for you.
Oh, thank you.
A stupid job, which is all about I. Look at me, aren't I clever? You do a job which is not that. It's about engaging people who find it difficult to cope with the world. And I think that's hugely commendable. I really do.
Oh, thank you so much. I do have one question about
you can have as many questions as you like. I'm not in a hurry. I'm not going
all right anywhere. Great.
I'm making soup at the moment.
So one philosophical question I find myself asking as a teacher, especially of Shakespeare. And I've asked, I actually interviewed another Shakespearean person. I asked them as well what their perspective was. So I'm curious what yours is. Obviously, a lot of my students sometimes have difficulty, once again, understanding language, things of that nature. However, a lot of the copies of the books that we have on Shakespeare is the copies that have Shakespearean writing on the left and the modern translation on the right.
Yeah.
Do you find, because often modern is easy to understand the plot better and the character, what they're saying better, but they miss the beauty of the language. Is it worth sacrificing the language for simplicity, or would you say maintain the language?
No, I think it's absolutely right. You know, I'm guilty of doing that as well. What's it called, that website that you can go on to?
Cliff Notes. It's Cliff Notes.
Yeah, something like that, yeah. And you can get, because you can get great insights into that. I think you're doing it absolutely right. I think that's great. Whatever it takes, because then they have to then try and put what that they're saying, but all they're doing is putting an action behind the word. I mean, acting is really just playing actions, isn't it? Really, you know, you're putting a verb behind what you're saying. What do you want to do with this person? What do you want to do with this line? Do you want to beat the person? Do you want to seduce the person? Do you want to, any verb, take any active verb and put it behind a line and say, now use that in the line and see where we're going in there. And so if they can get the sense of the line and understand what the action is behind that line, they can then go back to the line in Shakespeare. And you can say, now listen, that's what you're trying to do. You're trying to seduce the person with this line. Mm. Right? You can open a whole new world for them. You know, Shakespeare's brilliant stuff. I know he's a dead white male, and in today's society, you know, people go, oh, well, dead white male, don't do that shit, you know. But he wrote about, there isn't anything that happens in modern day that Shakespeare never wrote about. He wrote about every single emotion in the world that goes on.
You know, that's what I tell my students. I tell my students, because they always ask me the same question. I get that from every year from every student, which is, why do we read these fucking books from 1,000 years ago? I always say they survived 1,000 years because what they're talking about back then is still relevant now. And the best writers understood it the best.
Absolutely. I know, absolutely. 100%. You're absolutely right.
You know, the one thing, a question I was thinking about as well for you is that, obviously, as a Shakespearean actor and a very accomplished one, okay? Shakespeare.
I don't know. I keep trying.
I mean, Shakespeare is obviously writing about characters about 400 years ago because he wrote in the 1600s.
Yeah.
And you're thinking, and you have to identify and put yourself in the mindset of these people from long ago. As someone who has lived in multiple different countries, is finding that the people living in these other countries and your experiences and how we're all similar, does that help you get back to also different people in the past? Because it's a similar mindset of those, whether or not it's 400 years ago or across the pond, people are people, the thoughts, the desires, the motivations are the same. Or is that kind of a way to help you also reach backwards just as much as you would read maybe across the pond, like to say horizontally?
Do you mean is Shakespeare, something like Shakespeare, acceptable to in the Belgian Congo as acceptable as it is in England? Is that what you mean?
Or yeah, and how when you approach it as an actor, you can find yourself being able to reach those characters because you're used to seeing or realizing the people across the board are still the same.
Yeah, I mean, now there we are. Yes, an interesting example is there's a scene in this Macbeth film that where I'm talking to Ross about what's been happening and how it's, you know, and this has happened and this, I think it's the very end. And I said to Joel Cohen, I said, I can't just talk to him like, I can't just talk to him there and bring it all out without waiting for a clue from him. Because And what immediately sprang, he said, why? I said, because where I come from, there's a thing called this, there's an organization called the CIO, the Central Intelligence Organization. These people have permeated every corner of life. You don't talk about anything. If you say Emmerson Mnangagwa, who happens to be the present president, is an asshole and someone should string him up, you disappear. And nothing will be, you will never be heard of again. You will be fed to the crocodiles. Mm. And that happens quite regularly, people speak. So I said, in this time now in the play, it's being run as a police, if I can imagine it as a police state, wars have ears. Mm. So whatever I say to this character of Ross, who turns out to be an asshole in the end anyway, I'm not sure about that portrayal. It wasn't in my production, and it's a very interesting way of looking at a part. But I think the villain of the piece is Macbeth, and I think it should be in Macbeth. Mm. But the tone and the tenor which one adopts, the one I adopted, I said, is that viable? And he said, yeah, absolutely. Let me see what you mean. And when I said it, he said, no, that's absolutely great. You have to keep it private. You have to keep it private, but you actually have to walk on glass, really, because whatever you say, because Ross may not be on his side. Mm. Ross may immediately go back and go, oh, Lennox has been talking, but saying really bad things about you, kid. Mm. And Lennox ends up strung up. So Lennox has to pick his way through that speech. So in answer to your question, yeah, it was actually thinking of back home. How would I deal with this back home, talking about the president in this way? So that did inform how I approached that particular speech.
I mean, I think it's really fantastic. And I think in the movie that you're in, Tragedy Macbeth on Apple Plus, you're playing Lennox. And I find what's interesting about his character is that he's someone who doesn't trust Macbeth, thinks that he is a villain, but for quite a bit of the play, he's still living, you know, under the rule of Macbeth. He has it.
Well,
right away.
He starts, Denzel said to me, what is your relationship with me as a Lennox? I said, pretty much like my relationship with you as Denzel and me as Miles. I think you're the bee's knees. I think you're wonderful. I think whatever you do is great. So don't ask me ever to criticize anything, because he used to say to me, how was that, Lennox, if he did a speech? I'd always say, it doesn't matter. You know, I said, you could speak absolute gobbledygook and I could still think it's fantastic. So I said, I think it's exactly that. It's Miles versus Denzel. I think that I admire you, I think you're wonderful, and then you slowly start to do things that make me question what you're doing, until finally people start disappearing, families are being slaughtered, everything starts going up, and all the scales drop off my eyes, and I go, God almighty, this guy who I thought was the most wonderful thing in the world is now a complete bloody tyrant. Oh my God, what's happened? What has happened? I don't know what happens. The part of Lennox is very inconclusive in a way, because he just kind of disappears. But maybe that's what happens. Someone snatches him, or he ends up hanging from the nearest tree.
I'm gonna say, in your opinion, is Lennox more loyal to Macbeth or to the country?
No, I think to the country. I think if it was to Macbeth, he's playing Seton. Isn't that Seton, the character Seton, who's with Macbeth? No, I think Lennox is very much a man for Scotland. Yeah, and I think to the country. Yeah, but you know, obviously there is the way in which I approached it was that, you know, he thinks he doesn't dares in the very first scene when he talks about the knight being this and this has happened and everything. He finds it very difficult to talk to him because it's like me opening up a conversation with Denzel Washington. So it's that was kind of easy because I just play that. I play the reality of that situation and just with the lines I'm given.
So, I mean, obviously, everyone who knows Shakespeare knows the complexity of the language.
Yeah.
Does the complexity of the language affect your actual performance or how you approach it?
I think, you know, I know all these rules because I've been steeped in it for so long. I know all these rules that I apply to it. You know, why does it, why, when a character is speaking in verse and it's regular verse and it's, you know, it's got 10 beats to, it's fine. It's usually the character knows what he's talking about. When a character speaks in irregular verse, like Hamlet, to be or not to be, that first line, I think you'll find is in fact 11 beats. So, why is you, and it goes like that, or just 11, 11, 10, 11, 9, 10, 11. And you think, why is Shakespeare written this part like this? Well, he's written this part like this because Hamlet's undecided as to what he's going to say, who he is, where he is. So that gives me, that gives you the character, the actor playing it, a clue as to where his head is. Whereas, if he's saying, if music be the food of love, play on, and he's playing Orsino, well, Orsino knows exactly what he's talking about because he's a self-indulgent prick who's in love with love. So those sort of clues I pick up on quite readily. And I love being able to mine Shakespeare. I love, Adrian Noble, a wonderful director, said to me, you must mine it and you'll find gems in it every now and then. You'll realize exactly why he chose that word. And he paints lovely pictures. I mean, when you think Macbeth says, those O's are wonderful because the word, the letter O can be extended for 4 seconds. It can be a small O, or it can be oh, it can be, it's wonderful. But he says, oh, full of scorpions is my mind, dear wife. Now, what a picture. What a wonderful picture. And he paints the most extraordinary pictures with the English language. That's what's so compelling about it, I find.
Yeah, I mean, I must say, I find Macbeth is one of my favorite, it's my favorite Shakespearean play. I mean, it's phenomenal. But I will say, on some level, I do enjoy teaching Romeo and Juliet more, but I don't like the play as much, but I like teaching it more because I think it's more fascinating to my students. But Macbeth is so wonderful.
Yes,
and,
it is.
You know, and I think a lot of it is, like I said, the language and the complexity of Macbeth. It's such a wonderful examination of tyranny and on some level, or, you know, and it goes really well with the world going on right now.
Oh, wow. You can just say that again. Yeah. I mean, my favorite is Merchant of Venice. I'd always wanted to play Shylock because I can identify very, very easily with racism. I have a strong leaning to, I'm what's called a closet Jew.
Oh.
I have a menorah and I have little Jewish icons and things around my house.
Well, I'm Jewish as well.
Oh, you are?
Indeed.
Shalom, shalom.
Indeed.
And I've become more so, funny enough, living in America. In Africa, it's very interesting because my Jewish friends in Africa have always been on the left politically. And the great, the European Jews who were political in South Africa, people like Helen Suzman, Joe Slovo, who a Polish Jew who became head of Umkhonto we Sizwe, the armed wing of the ANC. These people were very dominant in my life, in my political life growing up in Africa, and they happened to be Jewish. My mother says in her book, The Toregs, the only people that ever treated her with kindness, she was brought up by nuns in a Catholic church, in a Catholic school, but the only people that treated her with any kindness were the Jews. So she always had a leaning towards Judaism. She kept a copy of the Torah and the Talmud in our house, which she used to read. And yet she also went to with my father to a Presbyterian church on odd days and holy days. So she was never a confirmed Jew, but and so I maybe that some of that has rubbed off on me.
Well, I mean, I going, having some stuff read some stuff about the character of Sherlock and how he's handled. There's some people who do seem to imply that there was a certain amount of racism for Shakespeare. Do you think that was the point of the story, or do you think some of that was because of contemporary feelings of the time?
Well, I don't think he was racist. You know, the Dark Lady of the sonnets, but the Dark Lady anyway was his life. And I'm trying to remember what her name was. She was a Sephardic Jew who a lot of Jews at the time of James II adopted. I'm trying to think what the word was. They didn't practice Judaism openly. It was banned, I think, in England. It certainly was in Venice at the time. I mean, there was a Jewish area in Venice during the time that Shakespeare wrote the play. But I don't think he was a racist. I think he was, when I played the part, it was very interesting because there were a tremendous amount of Jews in San Diego who came to see the play, and all of them had good things to say about it. They said, it was wonderful that you played him just as a human being. There was no side to him. He wasn't an evil man. He was a man who said, and after desperately trying to be friends with Antonio, Antonio says to him in the end, well, he says, well, okay, there's going to be a penalty. What's the penalty? And and Shylock said, well, a pound of flesh. When Antonio is complicit in stealing his daughter from him, the person who's going, you also have to remember that, you know, Shakespeare understood that the person that's going to continue the line of Judaism through for years to come, not the son, but the daughter, he turns against him. He goes, okay, the fucking pound of flesh, I'll take the pound of flesh now. Now let's see you bastard. And I played him with tremendous amount of sympathy because I had a tremendous amount of sympathy for him. I think the people, the evil people in that play are the Bassanios and the Antonios of this world. And Portia, you know, who's a little rich girl, you know, gets handed her career on a plate. Those awful people that we know who live in various areas. I'm not going to name anyone, any particular area, but of Los Angeles or New York or whatever. But those people that live there who are self-satisfied, contented with their life, and are also racist at heart. It's all very well, our Jewish friends, but let's not have them in the house. It's all very well, our Black friends, but let's not ask them around for dinner, okay? It was very interesting that I was told by someone, one of the Black actors in his name I will not repeat, while doing Macbeth, that he said to me, you know, Miles, the difference is in even in LA, he said, Black people don't tend to go to white people's houses for dinner. White people go to white people's houses for dinner, and Black people go to Black people's houses for dinner. I don't know whether that's true or not, but it came to me as a terrible shock. I thought, God, heavens above, haven't we moved on? Haven't we seriously moved on?
Well, like I said, I think Denzel Washington he did a fantastic job with it. I mean, he was a particularly contemplative Macbeth. I mean, some players, I think, play up more the tyranny and the craziness. He played up more, I think, the contemplativeness of the character, which I thought was interesting.
Yes, it was. Absolutely. It was a very interesting choice. I worked with him years and years before in Zimbabwe, of all places. I went home first time in 20 years on a film called Cry Freedom, in which he played Steve Biko as a very young man. So it was very interesting seeing his progression as an actor. He was still the same Denzel that he had been so many years before.
Well, the one thing I was thinking about, and you know, the thing with Macbeth, I mean, the play, not necessarily any particular actor, is that it's been performed and there's so many versions of the movie and the characters. When you're playing a part in Macbeth, you played Lennox, obviously Denzel did Macbeth. Are you acting with consciously based on what you're seeing from these other versions? Are you trying to avoid them? Are you trying to pick what you like from them?
Yeah, no, I don't. I try not to watch. I mean, I saw the Orson Welles Macbeth. I think there was another version of Macbeth, and I'm trying to think it was an English production that Roman Polanski directed. I saw that, and of course I saw Throne of Blood, Kurosawa's film. I try not to be affected by any of those different performances. And you know, so I've done the play. I played Ross and I played Macbeth. Now I played Lennox. At some stage I get to play Duncan, I suppose, and have my throat cut. But I try not to be influenced by any of them. And it's also to do, of course, with the other actor. The other actor is either closed off to you, which many are, or is absolutely open to you. And if he's open to you, as Denzel certainly is always, it makes it so much easier because you really can connect with this person.
Mm. You know, another thing I found fascinating about Joel Cohen's version of Macbeth is the setting. The sets were sparse, I would say. Very little design, very little detail. And I wonder, was that to develop the feeling of a play? Was it to highlight the actors far more so you had less distractions on the screen? How did that affect you as your performance? And what did you think about how the stage was set?
Well, I mean, I love that. It's what is it? 1:37:1 format, first of all. You know, that not square, but slightly near a little bit more than 4:3 or 3:4:3 format. Do you know a director called Tarkovsky during the 60s, 50s, late 50s, 60s?
I'm not familiar. Andrei
Tarkovsky. He was greatly influenced by Kurosawa. And you watch his films, they're very, very, very dreamlike. They have a dreamlike feel to the whole thing. He's been described as one of the truly great directors, and I think he only did about six films in his entire career. Yes, the one that is was called Andrei Rublev. That was someone completely different. Andrei Tarkovsky, he wrote a film called The Killers. He liked those tall sets, and so it wasn't realism. It was theatrical. And the choice of black and white, I think, was to make us feel, because it's quite closed in, isn't it? There is only one exterior scene, and that's at the very end of the film. And I think he wanted us to feel we were in a pressure cooker. We were in some sort of, in a pressure cooker, and that was how it was. I love the idea of being on the soundstage the whole time, because that's, and you know, we were also beset with COVID. So COVID interrupted. We had 4 weeks rehearsal, which was wonderful because it was like being in the theater, where we all talked about, discussed the scenes, discussed who we thought we were, et cetera, like actors do, get talk about themselves. Then we started filming, and then of course it all fell apart because COVID happened. So we stopped filming after 2 weeks, and we all said goodbye to each other, disappeared, and picked it up in August. We'd started in February. So that was very, very difficult. And then of course, when we were back in August, we had to abide by all these COVID rules. You couldn't, You couldn't rehearse. You had to rehearse with your masks on. And then only when the take happened, you could take your mask off, because you do know that you can't catch COVID during a take.
Of course not. just to interrupt, it reminds me of at school, we all have to wear a mask, except for our lunch, where we eat together in a small room. It's like, apparently COVID does not affect you during lunchtime. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, Tarkovsky also wrote, I think there's a film called Solaris. And I think it's Solaris, which is an early 2001 Space Odyssey. It's before 2001 Space Odyssey. And it's about this guy who has this, suddenly he's going around circumnavigating this planet called Solaris, and he conjures up his dead wife. It's a fascinating film. But it's someone's, I mentioned Andrei Tarkovsky to him, to a writer friend of mine. He said, what's it like? I said, well, it's kind of Tarkovsky, really. And he said, oh, do you mean dark, black and white, dark, and really slow? And I said, no, I don't know if it's dark or slow. I said, it takes you a long time to think of it. He used to take long, long time on shots. So a scene would seem to last forever. But he spent his time. And I think that's one of the joys of this film, is that it is like a dreamlike sequence for me. We're not actually in a real world at all. I mean, those opening scene when Macbeth and Banquo are walking towards the camera, it's a very strange scene because they're walking through this strange mist, and then the meeting with Catherine Hunter, who I thought was wonderful as the witch. Mm. I mean, absolutely transformative. It was just in another world. And I think maybe that's where he wanted to go with the film. I mean, I have no say in how it's depicted at all. That's his choice.
Well, another interesting decision they made in the movie, which I don't think I've ever seen before, but I may be wrong, I may be totally wrong. They showed Denzel Washington's Macbeth killing Duncan. They literally showed that moment. Usually, yeah, every play just implies it. You know, you see him walking out of the room usually. It's the first time I saw a thing in a movie where they actually showed that scene actually happen. And I thought that was a fascinating editorial decision by Cohen to make that decision as a way to, I don't know, maybe either show the ruthlessness of Macbeth or the tragedy for Duncan. I'm not sure, but it definitely was something I've never seen done in any other version.
Yeah, no, I don't think I ever have at all. I couldn't answer that question because I'm not inside the director's head. I always think the imagination is always a bit stronger. Mm. Maybe he thought there was no other way of doing it. You know, that wonderful scene in Once Upon a Time in the West, I think it is, when Henry Fonda comes across the little boy who's witnessed the murder of his parents by Fonda and his gang, and Fonda looks at the little boy, and the little boy looks up with his lovely little face, and the camera drifts off, and then you hear, pow! You realized he shot this poor little kid. So I always think that sometimes it's much more powerful to let our imagination ask for us to imagine what has happened. Mm. But maybe he really wanted to show just how bloody he was. And maybe he didn't think the audience were clever enough to actually let their minds wander.
Well, like I said, I thought the movie was fantastic. You were fantastic in it. Denzel Washington was fantastic in it. Frances McDormand was fantastic in it. And I hope our listeners check it out on Apple Plus, streaming now. And I want to, and Miles, I want to thank you so much for talking with me. You are amazing.
Hey, and Jeff, how are you?
And picking your brain about Shakespeare is a gift. So thank you so much.
Bless you. Bless you. Thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
And thank you so much. Have a fantastic night, sir.
I will indeed, and to you.